This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Jim Essen
and Bruce Markwell.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Jim, you were working in science-related activities in Palmerston North for most of your working life, I believe.
Yes, indeed. I was what was known as an entomologist, and entomology is just the study of insects. And in the early days, it sounds a long time ago, it's getting back a bit.
Can you put a year on
DSIR,
it?
DSIR, well, I'm talking in the 1950s,
yeah.
Is when I joined, and the DSIR was about 20 or 30 years old at that stage. It was relatively young. And they had a whole series of different divisions specialising in different areas of research. So there was a botany division, there was an entomology division, there was an ecology division. All the different branches of science had their own particular division.
Okay, so DSIR, that's not a university, that's
that was a department.
It
was
a government department?
A government department called the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research.
Okay.
People had some rather ruder names for it, but we won't go into those. It was an interesting organisation, and they had the so-called A and B divisions, which was the agricultural and biological divisions, were centred at Mount Albert in Auckland, here at Palmerston North at Grasslands, and at Lincoln. And what they tried to do was to put substations of all the A and B divisions together at those sites, so that the expertise was available wherever there was a DSIR group. So in Auckland, for instance, they had plant diseases division and a substation of entomology and a substation of botany and so on. And the same sort of thing happened here in Palmerston North. That was at Grasslands. And
so Grasslands was DSI was a subset of Grasslands.
Grasslands was a division of DSIR.
Ah, okay.
And there were two other main divisions there. There was plant chemistry division, and there was plant physiology division. And plant physiology division had a big they had growth chambers and so on, and they could see why and how different conditions made plants grow.
Okay. Now, at that time, Massey University didn't exist, but was there an agricultural college here?
There was indeed, and we had a close relationship with Massey. We had staff rights to visit Whararata, and we had used to use their swimming pool.
Which
was very useful, because the students were away most of the summer, and we found it was wonderful to have a swimming pool out there.
And you were based just over the road from the
university.
Yes,
and we were just across the road from Massey, so it was a close relationship. We were often I did some guest lectures and so on over there, so that when bits of the curriculum fitted, we would work in with one another on all sorts of bits and pieces.
Okay. So your work was mainly research?
Yes, it was. Entomology really was in about four main areas. Pest control, obviously that's a major one, and so you've got pests in pasture, pests in horticulture, pests in floriculture, all sorts of pest problems. You've got biological control, where they would look to see where the pest came from originally, why it wasn't a pest in that country, and then bring in the parasites and predators, which would bring the pest into control. But it was a specialised area.
Yeah, was there much sort of care taken with that? You could imagine you bring in a predator on the pest and find that it starts causing damage in all sorts of other
things. Uh-huh. Yes, that was certainly the quarantine insectaries were very closely guarded.
Okay.
And you had to be able to prove that in fact any of those things that were brought in weren't likely to become a parasite or a predator of any of our native insects before they ever got release permission. It was so there was quite a long process, and that's why they were a specialised group. There was another group called taxonomy, and they were the ones that found out what insects we've got and what they were called and so on. And so they were the main groupings within Entomology Division. We had a few chemists and so on as well, and so on to do some work on pesticides and that sort of thing. Okay. But those were the main groupings.
Were they mainly locally trained staff, or people from overseas came and worked there?
Initially, virtually all locals. Later, it was almost rare to find a local in there. The director of the time was very keen on employing people from overseas, and so we had a lot of people. We had some of them were very fond of South Africans and English people, and people from all around the globe that came in and worked with us. Yeah.
So what about the training? You could train for jobs at DSIR in local universities, or there were
better, I did my base degree at Victoria University, and the professor there was John Salmon, and John Salmon was an entomologist initially. He turned later into a botanist, but all John Salmon's early work was in entomology, and so the we basically and because of the way it was done, and I had to work all my holidays at DSIR, you kept up your entomological input while you're doing your degree.
Okay. And then with the how was it decided what research would be done? Was it funded by farmers or farmers groups or by taxpayer?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We were allocated research within our groupings, and I was always in pest control, and so I did pastoral pest control and so on. Well, initially I did a while in taxonomy,
but then got into the pest control as a more worthwhile, as far as I was concerned, much more interesting and worthwhile sort of an area to be in. But in those days, DSIR had a policy that you could do one day a week. On any particular piece of research that was of interest to you. And my particular love was cicadas, hence my car's called a cicada. And I tell people it's only because it works in summer, but that's not quite true. Cicadas were a particular interest of mine, and so we were allowed to do a day a week on research of interest to ourselves. And when DSIR and MAF, which was the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries Research Division, amalgamated and became the Crown Research Institutes, then things changed quite dramatically. And the funding had to, a large amount of the funding came from industry. So back in the earlier days, no, it was all government funded, and we didn't have to go out and find funding. I think that researchers today would be greatly envious, in fact, of that fact, that they don't have to go out and spend a fair bit of their research time looking for funding and being unable to publish because the information may be of use to their sponsor.
But and, also now that there's contestable government funds as well, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
Even with government money, you've got to make submissions and apply for it and compete.
Indeed. So it's a very different world. Research now is a very different world.
So were you mentioned publication. You were your target was publishing in journals and going to overseas conferences, or?
Yes, it was. I must confess, I wasn't a great publisher. I was much more of a talker, and I tended to do a lot of field days and conferences and that sort of thing. I didn't publish as much as I should have, and that, of course, did have an effect on your progress and through the system. Yes.
Yeah.
The those that could churn out a paper a month or so did very well. But
was it a lot of teamwork?
Mine was a much more limited effort.
So if you published, would it be under one name or a group of 10 or 12 names?
Usually, if you had a group of people doing the work, it would be published under multiple names. But the bulk of the work came under your own name, yes.
Okay.
I used to publish mostly in the Journal of Weed and Pest Control, and because that was the area that I felt most comfortable in, and that was
Now you said you had a particular interest in cicadas.
Yes.
Why was that?
I think because they don't scratch, they don't bite, they don't stink. They are beautiful things to look at. They are remarkable in a whole lot of ways. Each and every cicada has a different song, so that and it's only the males that sing. So, I mean, you can't have much better life than that, can you?
Now, when they sing, how do they sing?
They have what are called timbals, and they are a plate which has got muscles attached to it, and it buckles. If you imagine
putting a series of wrinkles into a tin lid and then pushing the tin lid, it would click, click, click as it went down and click, click, click as it came out because of the ridges.
Yeah. Okay.
The timbals are the same. They have ridges on them and they click at different rates. So, you know, there they are sitting back in the sun, enjoying life, singing away and having all the girls flock to them. I mean, you can't get a much better life than that. And hence I was greatly envious of them and my interest doubled, as it were. No, they're very beautiful things. Some of our cicadas are extremely beautiful.
But you wouldn't be paid to research them on that basis. Were they seen as a pest or a benefit to agriculture?
What sort of role?
There's only two or three reasons that cicadas become pests. They became a pest in kiwi fruit when we got disease into kiwi fruit, and it was found that it was through feeding scars that the pest disease transmitted, and that was a major one. They're not generally considered to be a pest of any magnitude, I think people like the sound. Well, I certainly do. It's to me, it's the epitome of summer.
So, how did you justify to DSIR you're specialising in, or was this your one day a week?
This is my one day a week.
Okay.
This is my particular area. There are a lot of species which are still undescribed and still unknown. And
species of insects in general?
Cicada.
Or types of cicadas?
Of cicadas.
Of cicadas?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
What role do they play in the insect world? You know, if that's all they do, they're not a pest or anything, what's their purpose?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure that they certainly are a feedstock, and birds and so on. A lot of insects prey on them. They are I couldn't really tell you that they had a purpose in life per se. They're just another one of the myriad of insects that we've got that have no particular.
So they've no role in pollination?
Mm-hmm.
They've no role in pollination?
No, they don't. No, they're sap sucking insects and they are very slow to develop. Very slow indeed. The big one that we hear in summer, the main one we hear, is a thing called Amphisalta, and that takes about 5 years below ground as a nymph. There are cicadas in the United States that take 17 years to develop. And I believe a lot of our mountain ones take even longer. I think that some of our mountain cicadas possibly take 15 to 20 years to go through their life cycle.
They're underground and they're...
The nymphal stages are underground, sucking sap from the roots. And of course...
Okay. And that's the problem for the trees?
It doesn't seem to be. Okay. They very rarely get in numbers big enough to be of a concern to the tree itself. You get nymphs in underground cells, and they suck sap and then molt and turn into the next stage nymph.
Yeah.
and get bigger and bigger until they eventually emerge, and as adults they're not around for very long, probably 2 or 3 weeks at the most, but their life cycle is really quite fascinating. Cicadas that laid this summer will start hatching in about September, October, and the young nymphs will drop down to the ground, burrow down underground and find a root here to get onto and start their life cycle. But the ones in the mountains, I know that I've come across nymphs that are frozen solid, so they, because of the shallow soils, and they're up at about 3,000, 4,000 feet, you know, they haven't got a hell of a lot of time to develop in short alpine summer. And
because... So they freeze solid in winter, thaw out and grow some more in summer and then freeze again?
Yes, they do. Okay. And that's why it takes so long.
Yeah.
I also believe that they... there's a lot of sugars in sap, but there's not a hell of a lot of protein. So the growth is slow from that type of feed anyhow. So they they're very slow growing insects. They fascinate me the way they can, you know. One will stop singing and all the others in the area will stop as well. How they...
Of danger or something? Is that because of danger or something?
Yes, indeed. And how they'll move around a branch to keep the branch between you and them.
So
it makes it harder to see and so on. They're fascinating things.
So are they sort of group animals and they show a certain amount of intelligence? Or they'd be individual?
I've never really considered them to show intelligence as such. But they certainly fascinate me with a lot of their behaviours. Which you could, I suppose, you could say yes, in terms of danger evasion and that sort of thing. They're really quite switched on. They know when to shut up and when to and when to sing. They only sing at above certain temperatures when they're somewhat more motivated. they're just a fascinating insect. And as I said, they don't have any of the nasty aspects of some of stinging or biting or stinking. They're just a very pretty animal. I can show you a small book that I've written on them if you like, and let you have a look at some of the some of the pictures in it to show you just how beautiful some of them really are.
So, did you find that the research findings were useful for farmers?
Not that.
What about the kiwi fruit you mentioned?
And that was only for a period of time, anyhow. Because when I joined Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries, I was into horticultural work, and it was a much more intense. Pest control operation. They had their research stations and so on were much better. Their research was better governed, I think is probably I've got to be a little bit careful what I say, but I think that they certainly
was it more task focused rather than basic research sort of?
Yes, it was. It wasn't. It was definitely focused very largely. We used to have meetings with the advisory farm advisory staff and the research staff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, SNIRAC was the Southern North Island Regional Council, and the farm advisors would get up and they would say what they considered to be a problem in their area and why farmers were having difficulty and what was causing them difficulty, and go to research and say, have you got any answers to that? Where do we go to find out? And if research said, no, we don't, but what we'll do is we'll instigate some research. Okay. So a lot of the research was instigated through those meetings, and it was very well organised and had a distinct and very focused basis.
A target to achieve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Had a target to achieve.
Yes. Oh, very much so.
So that was the focus before the commercialisation of research, was it? And then before Crown Research Institutes and so on. After which it was competing for pools of funding from producer groups?
Yeah. Once the Crown Research Institutes began, it had started before they began, but yeah. it was, farm advisors, for instance, had to go out and find somebody who was willing to pay for them and that sort of thing. And we were starting to look for outside funding before regional research or before Crown Research started. And nowadays, of course, it's very much that way, that contestable funding and funding from industry are very, very important.
Now, you've experienced both of those systems? You've worked under both those systems?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.